that people start wondering what is finding success in that they reach 30 without ever having had employment at any time. So in a way, this proposed tax incentive is meant to induce demand. It's meant to make it attractive to employers to give young people that opportunity. But of course, from conversations, from discussions with several people within government, outside government, there has been now the decision to extend this cost-sharing arrangement beyond just targeting young people, first-time job seekers, but also make it available to employers who locate their businesses in designated special economic zones, regardless of their age, because that's another target to try and encourage employment in those places. It's clear that, I mean, for young people, especially in an environment where people have got qualms about the extent to which the education system really enables them to be literate, to be numerate, to acquire skills that enable them to have something to offer their first employers, it's clear that signaling is not working terribly well. People tend to be very skeptical. You see this by looking at adverts. Most job adverts will always have this tag of experience or something like that. So one of the things that this initiative would try and do is to just deal with that kind of uncertainty or improve that signaling, say to people the risk, at least from a cost point of view, of hiring these young people is not too huge, and government is prepared to share that with the employers. Now, of course, in a way, we've got no illusions that a measure like this, you start implementing it and all of a sudden unemployment disappears. We are so aware that you need this, but it must be complemented by other things. And it must also complement other things for the kind of impact that's wanted to be achieved. It is for this reason that we would prefer that it should be kept simple. Well, you're trying to solve a big problem. You're trying to get people to help us solve a big problem. And therefore, if we put too many hurdles, if we put very onerous requirements, it might just put people off. Of course, this is not to suggest that the measures about protecting people from exploitation, from abuse, about making sure that the measure itself is not abused are not necessary, because I mean human things that involve human beings, you know, there will always be opportunities, there will always be tendencies not to do the right thing. So it is for that reason that the legislation has got measures that are meant to cap that. Let me just say that the last point I would make before I invite Mr. Mamonia to come in and take the committee through the detail is this. The logic, the public finance logic behind this incentive is no different from the logic in relation to other incentives. We've got a range of incentives. Honorable members would know that, for instance, we have built a very big motor industry, which is a substantial employer in the country, which also contributes to exports. We export 3 series BMWs to many parts of the world, including America. That industry is built on the back of incentives. The MIDP program, if you look at the budget review published in February, for 2010-11, which is the year at least that we could put together good enough data, accounted for tax expenditure to the tune of about 22 billion rand. Right? So in a way, that's intended to induce more than it would ordinarily do on its own. But of course, the argument of David Laws would apply there as it would apply here. Would they not have done it if there was no incentive? Who really knows? But there are things that you are better off not knowing sometimes, because in trying to know them, you may not live to tell the story. So you just want to make sure that you do your best to make sure that the right thing happens. On that note, Chairperson, I shall invite Mr. Momonia to go through the...
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think what we've done today is, as you know, we've got 17 submissions, both from trade unions, from business, community organizations, churches, and in the document which we outlined, we have a list of those. I think they are available, obviously, to all and sundry, their one copies. And what we do, as you do with normal bills, is the bill has been put out for comment, as you know. It is a money bill, so it's not formally tabled yet. But before we formally table, because money bills are dealt with through the money bills procedure, or amendment, whatever it's called, and other amendments bill, what we normally do, as with other tax legislation then, is to look at the comments, go through it, and indicate to you what our response is to the comments made, and how therefore the bill that was published would change in response to these comments. And obviously I think we take these comments very seriously, and that's why we produce a document which will go into it in a bit more detail. And the slides are just meant to cover what we have. So I'm going to jump to the third slide from this that you have, and come back to the slide that's published before this, because this is the sequence in which we've responded. I think what we're starting with is the first set of comments were that we've taken are conceptual in nature. And you heard some of these provisions last week. The first was that, and so not attributing these to specific comments, but if you look through the comments, you'll see several, particularly of trade unions, raise the fact that the bill should be not brought here, it should be subject to consultation within NADLAC, as it has major socioeconomic impact on labor in South Africa. We've not accepted this position because, firstly, we it's not really on the slide, but what we say is that it really doesn't affect the current workforce. So if you're employed, this incentive will not affect you. Okay. And if it works as we intend, we'll deal with abuses like displacement. But in fact, the bill affects those who are not currently employed. So perhaps that does, if it's very big, have some sort of socioeconomic impact, but it will not be on labor. It will be on those who are outside labor and in fact will join the labor force. And I would add, would also be potential members for the trade union, so they too can expand their membership. I think we've outlined that in terms of NADLAC itself, if you look at the process, that this is not a new initiative. This initiative was announced by the President in 2010 in his State of Nation address, and a year later there was a discussion paper which the Treasury had put out on Budget Day. These have, you know, we've received comments from many organizations and individuals. We've also had workshops within NADLAC, with, for example, labor, the community, etc., to go through these proposals. And though the process was not completed, and I should add that when we go to NADLAC, you know, we're not in charge of NADLAC. We're one of the parties, and it's up to NADLAC to then decide how they complete any process. We often just go and make a presentation, have a discussion, and that's it. And sometimes we go and there's a more extensive process, as it was for this particular initiative. And again, whilst a lot of the comments were almost to reject the incentive in principle, or the subsidy at the time in principle, we look into, it's on that point that we differ with many players, because we're saying we do have a problem. How do you deal with it? You're not saying this is a panacea. It's one of many measures that government has to deal with the problem of youth unemployment. As the DG said, it's experimental, and the idea is there's even limited kind of revenue that's foregone. If you look at the numbers, is there any reason why we shouldn't try it? And we were very open to alternative suggestions being made. And I should add, Chair, that we really didn't receive any other significant, I mean, a lot of people are against this, but are unable to say, but rather do A, B, C, D. And we tried to listen carefully. So we took certainly a lot of the issues on incentive design, the whole issue to detect abuse like displacements, bringing penalties for abuse. People felt that we shouldn't start it at too low an age range because you didn't want people to, young people to leave school and find work. So lots of those sorts of comments. And I think as DG has outlined, yes, every incentive we have, there's dead weight loss. Does it mean that we should therefore get rid of all our incentives? I don't think anybody's arguing that. Like with the other incentives, this one also has dead weight loss. And you try and minimize that, but you can't eliminate that because as the DG said, you know, you never know who would have done this had there been no tax incentive. I think just more formally what you say is that this is a money bill. It doesn't change labor relations, and therefore we're not compelled by law to take it to NEDLAC. But we have taken the idea to NEDLAC. But I'm just giving the legal position. I think, Chair, you did say that, you know, Parliament is the only supreme body here, and it approves or rejects or mans bills. And a similar argument applies to the National Youth Accord. We obviously support the broad objectives, but that doesn't mean that one party, and it could be business, it could be community, that just because they object, this bill, for example, can't come to Parliament. So I think for all these reasons, we've said that, you know, the consultation process may not be perfect, but it has been done. You don't always reach consensus, but that doesn't mean that therefore governments is not allowed to come up with a proposal and put it to Parliament. The other conceptual objections that we saw related to SEZs and designated industries, and here too I think we really couldn't agree to the reasons outlined. And the reason for this is South Africa, again, like other countries, competes for investment, and you know, you offer a suite of incentives. Most of these incentives result in capital intensive investment, in fact. But we want to obviously attract investment where there's job creation. And in this instance, if you look at the process for SEZs, that's been through another committee. The concept's been accepted, and all we are doing is to also offer this incentive, but not just to young people. As you know, in SEZs, it could extend, it would apply to all low-income people in the range that we're looking at. I think that the points we made, and Chair, you raised some of the issues. Is there a different? Will this mean that there are different wages for subsidized and non-subsidized workers? No. The wages will be the same whether you subsidize or not subsidize. The difference is the cost of the employer, because the employer will presumably pay the same. But if you subsidize, the employer is getting something back for the subsidized workers, those who are eligible. And you could be in the system, subsidized, but once the 2 years come up, the employer needs to continue employing you. So, I don't know if anyone else wants to add this one, SEZs or any, Chris or Male, Profundi?
Perhaps one, sorry, Chair, Honourable Members. Perhaps one comment is that at the moment we have a lot of tax and other cash incentives for establishing companies, expanding companies. and that will also be the case for ECZ, but all of these incentives are based on capital. That means that we attract capital-intensive operations, and one thing that this incentive can do is to tip the scales in favor of labor.
Okay, so maybe, okay, I'm not going to go through all the points in this slide because there's a lot of repetition. I think you'll hear these, but just to show you what factors we've considered, and the document itself goes into much more detail. I think the other point conceptually that particularly many of the unions objected to was the issue of displacement and the downward pressure on wages, something that you had also raised in your conclusion at the last session. I think again here we felt that the unions were sort of saying this, but there wasn't much evidence to support what they were saying. I mean, workers are not completely substitutable. That's our point. And we think that the specific provisions to penalize employers who displace workers to get incentive can kind of deal with some of the problems that labor was faced. Obviously, we're all concerned about it. And so the question was, how do you design the bill? How do you design penalties to try and discourage abuse in the system? I think like any tax incentive, nobody can say there will be no abuse. There will be some abuses, but let's get this in proportion. It's almost akin to saying, you want to destroy the hen, do you demolish the whole house, or do you use more effective and more targeted penalties to try and deal with the ants in the house if you don't like ants in the house, that is. And as I said earlier, we don't really believe that this has an impact on labor legislation or labor relations. Hence, it is a money bill. So I think, we don't want to start by just saying no, no, no. But what we're saying is these were all the conceptual issues. You would see that they are kind of similar. There's obviously repetition, but we thought we'd just try and typify them as these were the three major comments that were made. Once you get away from the conceptual, and there were many specific and I think some very good proposals made. I think the first one, which really was a very good suggestion, is the point made that the incentive wasn't linked explicitly to the many skills training or skills development and training programs that government has. Again, I think the problem we faced here was that we accept in principle that we should try and do this. We're not sure that we can do it immediately, because if you look at the take-up here, in this case, it's not just big companies that are going to take up. As you know, the potential for job creation lies with many small businesses. And what you hope here is that, tens of thousands of small companies take up this incentive. Now, there are issues about how they can tap funds from training programs, CETAs, etc. And what we want to do is consult our colleagues in the Department of Higher Education in Labor to see how we can make it easier, even for small companies, to access training. If that access is easy, and Cecil, you can just come in and maybe describe how the learnerships network, if members need an explanation. Then we can obviously make this obligatory, that if you take a worker and use this incentive, then you must train that person. We can't do it now, because if we were to put that in place, we think we would limit employment. But on the other hand, nothing stops us that once this incentive, if it's approved by Parliament, to very aggressively point out to youth, who, for example, will take up this incentive, that there are training opportunities and ask employees to try to take up the learnership and apprenticeship and other training mechanisms that are available. But what we've done in the meanwhile is also to put in a clause that will say that should it say in a year's time we sort things out with the Department of Higher Education, the minister could begin to prescribe this as a condition. But we don't think it should be done at this stage. We think we could try and do that for the second stage. But if we could do it even before the second stage, there is a provision now in the bill that would enable us to do this. I don't know if anyone in the team who's a, I'm certainly not an expert on the training. Cecil, don't you want to say a few words?
Thanks, Omar. Thanks, Lee. I think on the trainings, Chair, the leadership initiative that we have as a tax incentive is there, and it's linked to the CETA training program. And what we envisage is that at the beginning, companies can access the leadership together with this particular incentive. Over time, as Momo has indicated, you could link the two and make the one conditional on the other. And that would not be too difficult to do, but I think to do it immediately is going to be a bit cumbersome. But it's just very important to note that currently there are tax incentives for training for young people that goes on to formal learnership programs.
So, Jay, we certainly accept this suggestion in principle. We accept it, and we would like to have made it an obligation almost immediately, but we think doing so will actually limit the take-up in quite a fundamental way. And we've got to perhaps just deal with our own issues. Then, Chair, to move on to the next slide. We did make lots of adjustments, and particularly many of the unions raised this, as well as BUSA in their submission, that some of the approaches that we took towards some of the... Oh, okay, you've got the eligible one here. Let me deal with this first. As we heard from the presentation, we were asked to review the age range. On one hand, there were people, certainly when we were designing the bill, who felt that it shouldn't incentivize young people to leave school or have that perverse outcome. But for example, as we heard from the Catholic Church last week, when they were arguing for us to look at 15 to 19, we felt just given that perverse outcome, we could go down but perhaps a year, and if you look at the data, that would help. So we are suggesting that we'll bring it down to 18. We don't think we should bring it down to 15 because, as I said, there would be perverse. We are worried about the perverse outcomes. In terms of the issue of how young is young, should we extend it to 35? Firstly, if you look at the data, your youth unemployment is concentrated below the age 29. And we feel that that's where we should target, and that's where the problem is, because there, over 50% are unemployed. That's the range, okay? And I think we have made available the data, certainly in the papers that we published in 2011. And you would see from that, and certainly we've got experts here who can go through it. I know Fundi would have ideas, so maybe I'll ask her just to say something about that if she wants to. But the other categories that we were asked to look at is asylum seekers, and we've accepted that proposal, so asylum seekers will be included. I should add that the bill applies to permanent residents, so it doesn't just apply to South Africans. And we've stopped it there because we feel that if you go beyond that, you're going to create perverse outcomes where people are brought in from out of the country and they shouldn't be able to get a residency, a work permit, on the basis of using the incentive. It should rather be that once people are here and they are entitled, that's when the incentive should be applied. I don't know, Fundi, if you want to say anything or just on this bit.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I think what we do find just from data and analysis that has been undertaken is that also as people get older, there is a perception amongst employers that they're more mature and more trustworthy and more responsible. And there might be a change in the way that workers are seen when they are a certain age. But because of the concentration, we believe that when we are still experimenting with the incentive, it's better to focus on the lower end, bring people in and give them that initial level of work experience. We can then review at the end of the 3 years whether we are observing a change in the patterns or not.
Okay, Chair, I'm going to move much faster. next one. Yeah. I think the other issue was, yes, you want to quickly talk through these. I mean, there were a lot of technical suggestions about the definition of employee, etc. All of that has been taken into account, including accommodating those employees who may be registered for PAYE and they are not currently registered. There were issues that when the minister designates industries, he should consult with the ministers of labor and trade and industry. We've accepted those types of suggestions. But let's hold, I'll just move faster and should people want more info we can come to. We were also asked to extend the amounts. And of course, however we do this, there's going to be a cliff or you're going to have some tapering. At the moment it's 4,000 to 6,000. And I think once we've heard people, some people wanted us to bring the amount down below 2,000 rand. Some people want us to take it right up to 10,000 rand. We felt that, to some extent we should stick to the range, but there are some adjustments on grossing up and down that we've taken into account so that part-time people could be included. Do you want to say something, Beyonce, on that?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mama, honorable members. If we just look at the way the bill is structured, we basically ensure that if a person works for, say, half a month, that in order to determine how much of the incentive the employer would qualify for, we would allow the bill basically, the employer to gross up the salary of the employee as if the person had worked for the entire month, so that you would not be basically incentivized to only employ people for, say, half the period and they get the same amount of incentive as you would for a person who's employed for the entire month. However, once we have worked out the incentive, then of course you are only allowed half of the incentive, so then there's a grossing down mechanism as well. So basically what it ensures is that you have parity and you've got fairness between an employee that is employed for part of a month vis-a-vis an employee that is employed for a full entire month. If I can just say in terms of the previous slide, that Mama was just speaking about in terms of the registration of employers. What we had initially is it was only effective in terms of persons who had to register for employees tax, employers. What we now have is if in fact an employer is registered for employees tax and we switch on the reimbursement mechanism, that person can qualify from day one. So that means whatever has rolled over up until the period where the reimbursement process is switched on, that person will then be eligible to claim that. So that will particularly be effective for informal employers, more smaller employers who are not currently registered and who will register at a later point. Thank you.
And then, Chair, I think there's been a whole host of suggestions that we accepted. So the approach we've taken is we're not going to repeat what's there in labor legislation. There may just be some referencing, but largely I think it was accepted that people who are employed will be protected by the normal labor mechanism. So there was no need for us to deal with that. There was an issue around displacement, but beyond that, I think there's not much we had to do. I don't know, Beyonce, if you can come in.
Basically, what we've got is two specific anti-avoidance mechanisms to deal with areas where employers are not meeting the labor law obligations, but where we can see the effect and feel the effect in terms of the incentive. And that is in two specific areas. The one is if the employer is not paying minimum wage. So what we're doing at the moment is the employer will still be able to claim the incentive. So we've taken into account the comment that we should not punish employees or future employees of the employer by kicking the employer out of the incentive. However, the employer will, because this is part of your employment tax system, will have to A, pay back the incentive that was unfairly claimed in terms of the person that they paid a wage below the minimum wage, and then secondly would have to pay a penalty of 100% on top of that. In the case of the displacement, what we've got at the moment is instead of, again, kicking the employer out and thereby negatively affecting employees in the future to the extent even maybe of totally destroying the employer and then the current employees no longer have a place of work, what we're doing is we're saying the penalty will be 30,000 rand per displaced employee, which is, if you look at the total value, that the maximum value that an employer can draw over a two-year period for the employee would be 18,000, and we've made it 30,000, which is a kind of a good solid number. And then if you look at what we do for the employer itself, is that should we've done this so that ministry can determine by regulation, they should have found that an employer has severely abused this, and a number of employees have been displaced in order for the employer to access the incentive, then the minister can, by notice in the Government Gazette, make sure that that employer no longer qualifies. However, in doing so, two things will be taken into account, is the severity of the displacement, but on the other hand, to counteract or to balance that out, to look at what will the effect be on current employees of that employer, so that you don't destroy future work opportunities and current work opportunities for employees. Thank you.
So, Chair, both displacement and minimum wages, I think we've tried to just have a more proportionate punishment so that you don't destroy the company and therefore destroy more jobs. I think the point was made last week in one of the submissions that we shouldn't be, in this way we could be punishing employees if we were too draconian, to use the word again, in our punishments. So we don't want to be draconian here. Okay. With regard to, what's this? A lot of issues on drafting. Beatrice has been very busy doing and fixing things up, but you'll see there's an ability to move on. And people wanted us to move the date of implementation. We thought we should stick to first January. We want to target the school leaving cohort that comes out. And then just to emphasize the last point, I think, here is there are strong monitoring and enforcement provisions that are introduced. Certainly, FEDUSA had raised this in quite a strong way. So SARS will certainly be tapping information, will be publishing information so that interested parties will know what the take-up is, what abuses there are that are reported, so that we have a sense of these. And I think we've outlined the penalties and so on, so you've seen the enforcement mechanisms. And certainly I think that once this information is out in the public, as we've said, there will be a review of the grant. And there was a provision to say it should be not 3 but 5 years. I think in principle we're saying if this works, it will be maybe even longer than 5 years, maybe 10 years, or to resolve our problem. But it will apply for 3 years, and then we have no doubt we'll be making some revisions. And with all this type of information, we'll be able to do that. Let's move on so that I can finish up the slide. Chair, you've also got slides just for your benefit on all the tax incentives that are currently there in the system, as the DG had outlined these, but there's more information. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mo, DG and your team. Honorable members, we've had the report from the Commission of Treasury. I'll open the floor for questions of clarity and comments. Over to you. Honorable Tim Harris, first, followed by Madam Amy. Those are the two heads. Then we'll have the shortest meeting. I only see two heads.
I'll try and fill the time, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. It is very difficult, however, if we only get the documents when we walk into meeting, especially with as substantive as what you presented today. So, Chair, if I can just ask again, and I appreciate if you underline this from the Chair, that we really do need to see the stuff beforehand. It's almost impossible to get your head around it while you're listening to a presentation. The DG's point about our unemployment rate being the same as Greece and Spain now, that's true by the narrow definition, but the real problem in South Africa is you have a huge number of job seekers that have simply given up looking. So by the expanded definition, we are still, I believe, the highest in the world. In fact, I haven't seen another emerging market or developed market with expanded employment, unemployment as high as ours, which underlines why an incentive like this, which would help to give some young job seekers some experience and a foot on the ladder, will make them more employable and directly target that problem of disenchanted job seekers who see no hope of getting a job. So that's why the DA supports an intervention like this. But Chair, we do still have concerns about the status of this Act, and then a couple of concerns about the design elements that the Treasury hasn't tackled today. Can I start with the status of the bill, Chair? The NEDLAC Act says in Section 5 that the Council will seek to reach consensus and conclude agreements on matters pertaining to social and economic policy and consider all significant changes to social and economic policy before it is implemented or introduced in Parliament. I think if you listen to those words, you will see why this is a concern for us, Chair. The NEDLAC Act specifies that any significant changes to social and economic policy must be considered there before introduced in Parliament. I think we would all agree that this is a significant change to social and economic policy. It hasn't been considered by NEDLAC. They have not reached consensus or concluded agreements before it was put before this committee, Chair. So I think we have a very serious concern that the very tabling of this bill before this committee breaches Section 5 of the NEDLAC Act. And Chair, that is underlined by something that Kasati told us in public hearings, where they said the youth wage subsidy has not been discussed at NEDLAC. Treasury just dropped it there and didn't come back. And that's a line direct from the presentation. Now, either Kasati is not telling the truth, or Treasury isn't. Chair, Treasury said there were discussions at NEDLAC, and Kasati said there weren't. It's a fundamental point. And I think we need, as a committee, to get to the bottom of it. Even if there were or weren't discussions at NEDLAC, the point is there's been no report written by NEDLAC. And publishing a report is how NEDLAC complies with Section 5 of their Act, that they need to reach consensus and conclude agreements. So I think there's a major concern remaining there. I also note on Site 5 of Treasury's presentation that they don't list the unions under the groups that gave comments. They talk about community organizations, business, individual employees, and individuals. So can you please explain exactly what happened at NEDLAC? That's the first question that I would like answered, Chair. Then, Chair, there were various questions which I actually asked last time Treasury didn't answer. And I would appreciate it if they would try and answer everything that I asked today. Because we do have the statement from Deputy Minister in the Presidency who said that the amounts of money the Finance Minister allocated to the youth wage subsidy no longer exists under that name. The $5 billion that was announced is going into youth employment support. Now, when a minister in the Presidency says something like this, Chair, Parliament sits up and takes notice. What that statement says to us is that the Youth Employment Accord has replaced the youth wage subsidy. It's clear as daylight. If that is the case, Chair, I would like to know Treasury's view on how this committee should regard the Youth Employment Accord. Is it simply a guideline that was signed in some meeting by a few stakeholders? Or is it something that has the status that the Deputy Minister in the Presidency says it does? Because that's a key consideration for us. If we have to regard this Youth Employment Accord as binding, then it's clear that that condition on page 14, all incentives must be approved by all constituencies, simply doesn't apply in this case. We heard it with our own ears when Kasata and Nunes presented to ourselves. Thirdly, Chair, this committee noted Kasata's the last line of their submission, where they said they're committed to resisting the passing and implementation of the bill and making an urgent political intervention to stop it going ahead. So we're busy legislating here in this committee, but I would like to know from Treasury if there's anything else going on that we should know about. Have there been any attempted intervention in any way? Have they received any communication? I think we're continuing here, as we should, but we do need to know if there are any other interventions that have happened, the Treasury, any communications on this the Treasury has received. Then, Chair, the one thing that's changed, or there are many things that have changed between the original policy and this bill, but we now have this word sunset clause, and this caused a bit of confusion, which Momo, I think, explained in the public hearings by saying it's not a two-year sunset clause, it's a three-year sunset clause. The reason that 2 years appeared in the original presentation is because those are the last 2 years left of the MTEF. I just want to double check that that's the case. Because the phrase Sunday clause does imply something stronger than simply a 3-year incentive that runs out at the end. And then related to that, Chair, it was always useful in the original policy that we had an estimate for the total cost of a 3-year youth wage subsidy of around 5 billion rand tax loss. Now, one of the questions from this committee should be, how strong is this incentive relative to that original 5 billion rand tax loss? And the number we've had is 1 to 2.3 billion. Does that mean that this is one-fifth up to one-half as strong as that original incentive? And if I'm not right in that calculation, can Treasury give us an updated equivalent figure for a 3-year implementation so we can compare this bill to the original policy that we had? If the original policy was 5 billion, what is the number we can attach in tax loss to this bill? Chair, I think Treasury has made some movements answering some of our concerns in the draft, which, by the way, we don't appear to have. It would be quite useful to see the draft Treasury is saying the concessions have been made in. But I still think that one of the problems with this bill is that it leaves young people, those young people that are most in need of the help, unsubsidized. So if you're a part-time worker, Chair, in the social services or community sector, you don't have a minimum wage sectorally determined. And if you're paid a low salary, you're not subsidized because of your 2,000 rand sub-minimum. To me, that's a problem, Chair. And I don't think Treasury's made any effort to try and solve that. Secondly, if there is concern about substitution, the most vulnerable group are existing young workers. And the original design of the youth wage subsidy provided for a subsidy for existing workers to make sure that that most vulnerable group is not substituted. That has been totally removed. Are we not concerned about that? Are we satisfied that that group is sufficiently protected by the measures that we have in the bill? My last concern on that, Chair, is that your ability to claim back is still limited to the size of your PAYE bill. So if you had a very large business that employs a whole lot of young people, but only very few managers eligible for PAYE, you actually can't get benefits for employing new young people because you'll run out of PAYE to claim back. I really think the original version, Chair, that allowed for a simple payout, it would have much better design. And we're essentially limiting the take-up here artificially. Chair, I've gone on for a long time, so I'll leave it there. I do have one or two other concerns. Perhaps if they're not asked by other members, I'll follow up.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the National Treasury led by the DG Sabongazi. Chair, firstly, I would like to thank the department for responding accurately on the presentations that were made by the stakeholders. And you have also even highlighted what was proposed, that some of them you agree with them, but I will try and indicate to some that I do not agree when you agree on them. Now, if you look at the skills and development and training that are proposed by some of the stakeholders, I share your commitment towards that. But however, we don't need to agree as a department on this proposal. The reason being, we are already having an instrument that is looking after that, after the skills and training, which was designed in 2002. And what the department is doing right now, you are offering an opportunity, an entry level to the market of the people that have never been employed. So it's an entry level. This person does not have a skill, he has the matriculation, maybe he doesn't even have the matriculation, but he's still young. So this is what you're doing. So and you have got something as government that is looking at this. So this must not be the department's worry, as far as I'm concerned, because there is a human that is looking at the skills and training, much as they've accepted, but I don't think really it is necessary. And the eligible employees, which is part two of the draft of the proposed amendment. Chair, with this one, I've got a few concerns. If, Chair, you go to cross three, I would propose that clause three of part two and clause three, paragraph A, where you're saying that you're trying to give who is an eligible employer, who is an eligible employer. You know, Chair, there, I am thinking about the brokers, those people who provide employees to the MTN, to the Vodacoms, you know, and the employees, so much, a huge number of the youth. Now, because of that, they end up, by definition, not becoming employers, but they do deduct for pay as you earn. I mean, the Vodacoms, the MTNs, they don't become the employers or the employees. The what do you call them, those agencies? Labor brokers, yes. The labor broker become an employer of the employee. Now, my proposal is try and craft something around that so that they are not being excluded. Because if you look at the proposal as such as stands, they are excluded. And they will fall in between. The labor broker will say, we are employers, and Vodacom will say, I am not an employer. So try and clarify so they don't have a dispute within that. Now, still on the eligible employer and the employee, you're saying to accept, where am I now? Where you accept, yes, workers with an asylum seeker's permit will be included. Now, I don't have a problem. You know that our constitution is put it so clearly. I don't have a problem with that. But I do have a problem where we are having an instrument, and this instrument is still an experimental instrument. That's what I'm saying. This is an experimental instrument. What we're doing now is just, we're going to implement it for the shorter period because it's experimental. We're not too sure. We are sitting with a huge problem. Nobody's telling us what to do. Everybody's complaining about what we're proposing. But the bottom line is there is a problem. The problem is the entity is huge. And as a result, you, government, you are saying this is an experimental. Now, why it is an experimental initiative, I will request that let us focus on the permanent residents. Let's focus on the South African permanent residents. And then as we move further, then we can, we'll see with the effectiveness. We'll do the monitoring, so we'll see, and then we'll act accordingly. So just have your mind on what you've accepted there too, but I've got a bit of concern there. And now, Chair, the other thing while I'm on that, it's about this initiative that we are offering, which is good. But I will also propose that what the DPG said, that after 2 years, at least those employers, they must employ those employees. Now we have to make it obligatory. It has to be an agreement. Because if you don't do it, you're going to see what we are seeing right now. And we are seeing some, especially of the youth, complaining about this because it has happened with the leadership. Where even our own state-owned companies, they take leadership about 40, 50, and after 2 years, they release them, they get jobs, they don't go back to those people that they've developed and give them skills, they employ another new people. So to stop the fact is that people don't just push the people out so that they want to claim. They want to benefit, not to claim. They want to benefit from the incentive. We need to monitor that. if you do have a job, because it will also be paid, I mean, I hope they will have positions. If you do have positions, make sure that you employ those people. Try and make it within the agreement, like it's a compulsory thing that you have to do it because you have benefited for out of this person. Now, Chair, the department is saying they've done effective consultation. I'm comfortable with that, including the NESLEC. It was an efficient consultation. Consultation has got no criteria which says if I consulted with so many people, then it becomes. So it was enough. If you have seen it, it's enough. It's your own assessment. It is enough. Especially, Chair, because what is being proposed by the department really it makes no sense to the many bills about allocation of the funds. And I want to understand this one this very well, because I think that's where the confusion is coming, even within us here. Okay. Here is the initiative that is being put by the department, the government. The government is saying, Company A, if you employ so many people, this is the incentive that you want to give it. I think that's why the treasurer chair moved from the subsidy to the incentive, because it's my understanding, unless I am wrong. Because you are saying, if you have employed these people, you are to, after that you are to deduct a compulsory pay as you earn. Isn't that so? Now, we are saying, when you deduct that, that's when you're going to benefit. I don't know. And it's going to be managed by the SARS. And if that is the case, where is this concern about the claims, who's claiming, and this I don't understand. I think that, but you need to explain this to everybody so that everybody understands it, because I do understand what you're saying, but there's a bit of a confusion here. There's a bit of a confusion. We need to clarify that this is what you are saying. Because it's like there is going to be an allocation of the public funds, in particular for this thing. So let us try and clarify as to how is it going to work. Maybe at the end of the day, we're not going to have the confusion. Chair, I'm sure it's slide 14, the DG didn't go to it, but I'm just going to quickly highlight on it. It's about monitoring. Chair, we will appreciate as ANC if when this is being done, it becomes a collective. A collective in the sense that it touches to all departments. We cannot take the whole burden of monitoring to the National Treasury. The PTI must be there to monitor whether the instrument is effective. The Department of Labor must be there to monitor that the instrument is effective. Because if they don't do that and that is being left to the National Treasury and SARS, then that is going to be a problem. All parties involved, they must be active. I thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? Allow Treasury to respond. Okay. DG, Momo, and your team.
Chairperson and Honorable Members, thank you very much. I'll tackle all the easy ones. Let me just. I mean, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on the consultation at NEDLAC and, in a way, respond to the Honorable Harris. First, we wouldn't be accountable for there being no report from NEDLAC if there was none out of our hands. On what happened at NEDLAC, truthfully, I can say I went there twice myself to present on the original proposal. In fact, some of the pronouncements people would have heard in public on the original proposal were out of the consultation that occurred in NEDLAC. So it's a fact. Thirdly, I think that whilst I wasn't there and I'm not a lawyer, the people who drafted the NEDLAC Act were careful about how they set out the different provisions in Section 5. On certain things, they're very clear that before introducing something to Parliament, it must go before introducing it to Parliament. I will take the clause that Honorable Harris read and another one to illustrate the example. The clause that Honorable Harris read reads, the Council shall seek to reach consensus and conclude agreements on matters pertaining to social and economic policy. They will seek to, right? But on, that's 5.1b. But on 5.1c, it says, consider all proposed labor legislation relating to labor market policy before it is introduced in Parliament. It means they hadn't forgotten when they were drafting the one clause above that one on inserting before introducing to Parliament. I've got no problem whatsoever, and the legal opinion that, I mean, I'm talking, when I say legal opinion, I'm former, so that you don't ask me to give it to you, at least for my team, that the correct interpretation of Clause 5.1b is not that there must be agreement before submitting to Parliament. It is that you must seek to have it, but failure to have it cannot amount to you stopping there. Now, if there's a different interpretation, I would be happy to know it. So, I had thought that you were referring to 5.2, so you are referring to D. But there again, it says, shall continually evaluate the effectiveness of legislation and policy affecting social and economic policy. Am I reading a different D? Sorry, I'm about to apologize, I moved to 2. Consider all significant changes to social and economic policy before it is implemented or introduced to Parliament. It's a judgment call on that, because, I mean, the point that we make in the presentation, which is that the consultation that's envisaged there can never take away two, I would call them original powers. The one of the executive to submit or introduce law to Parliament, and the other one of Parliament to process the legislation when it's presented to it. Because if you were to then make it a barrier, not just a hurdle, a barrier to take things beyond that, then it means these two very powerful institutions that have got powers given to them by the Constitution can be used up by neglect. I would hesitate to put the kind of interpretation that being put to that provision. So that's our take on that. And I think my suggestion, at least from my team, is that let's leave that one at that point, because our interpretation, the interpretation we've received from the lawyers we work with, certainly internally, is that the consultation that's envisaged in 5, except in instances where things affect labor, about changing labor legislation, hence the pullback. Because as a matter of fact, we were not changing labor legislation, we were cross-referencing it. We were demonstrating that none of the provisions in this Act seeks to undo that which is provided for, given or whatever, in labor legislation. Now that got us into trouble in terms of interpretation, I would say. So we pulled back because we lose nothing from that. The other laws that deal with labor issues stand and they will abide. That also takes me then to the point that the Honorable Mike Amin was raising, that we should compel employers to keep the people after 2 years. That immediately walks into that problem, Honorable Megan, because that's a very profound legislative provision. We would wish that people keep the people so that net employment changes beyond the provision of the subsidy. However, there are provisions in our labor laws about how employers relate to employees, how they keep them, under what circumstances they can lay them off. and so on and so forth. The moment we walk into that territory, that will cease to keep this legislation as a money bill that the Minister of Finance only has got authority to introduce to Parliament. And so he will be now dipping into, he will be intruding into, if that's the right English word, into the territory of his colleague. Let me also say this, which is connected to the issue of training, which had been asked before, people commented on. Whilst there may be tasks that people get employed to do, which may be so menial that you could say they learn nothing, but I'm yet to find an employer. I'm really yet to find an employer who is rational, as most economic agents are, who will say, I'm happy to have this young person doing nothing because the other portion of his or her wage is subsidized by government, and therefore they learn nothing. So I suspect that the preoccupation, the correct preoccupation, by the way, if I may say, with making sure that people also acquire skills and there is a connection to training, need not be exaggerated to a point where we suggest that being employed does not immediately, excuse me, expose you to learning. Now, I'll do something that I'm not allowed to do because I also studied statistics. In the Treasury, we have got someone who's now a personal assistant at a very high level, at the highest level that a personal assistant can rise to be in the Treasury. When the Treasury first made contact with the person, she was a security. Right? She was a security. She moved from that, occasionally became a receptionist. And people got to know about her. She was able to put records in a way that makes sense. And when she was a receptionist, full-time, she had the opportunity to sometimes sit as a PA for someone when the PA was not available for part the time in a day. Later on, that graduated to becoming for some days when the PA was not there. That saw the person becoming a PA and rising within the ranks. Moral of this, which I don't want to overgeneralize, but it does happen, is that by being in a work environment, people get exposed to things that are useful, that are valuable, in building them as workers. You can't learn them sitting in basking in the sun or whilst you are at home making tea and stuff like that. But by just being in a work environment, people notice you. As a person, you notice things, you learn about things. In addition to just the discipline of relating to an employer, relating to a supervisor, understanding that there is a contractual arrangement, there are deliverables that you have got to meet, and so on and so forth. So people shouldn't underestimate just the fact that you've got a job. People pay you for it. They expect you to deliver something, changes the person's makeup, and allows them to develop and learn several useful things. Let me partly respond to the issue of the 2000 excluding young people. I say partly because there's a part of it that I didn't quite understand from the Honorable Harris. But let me say this. You see, there is no exclusion for people who earn below 2000. Where that is by agreement in the sector, right? The incentive, yes, where there is an agreement. Where there is no agreement, then there is an exclusion. Now, I actually would suspect that I don't have sense in this, that there will not be too many jobs in South Africa. There may still be, but there will not be too many jobs that fall below them. I'm in the farming sector. We are compelled to pay $2,274.80. Now, you could say it's high, but I do know that there are sectors where there are agreements that are slightly below that. Now, the original proposal just so you know, we didn't have that minimum. But again, informed by the consultation, which is why I don't know how to get this off our backs. We consulted, and the reason we have a legislation that's different in content and substance from the one that we would have had there been no NEDLAC process is because there was consultation at NEDLAC, there was consultation outside of NEDLAC. We heard people and we made changes that were informed by them. Now, I mean, I'm hoping around, this is going to be the last one for me before I take whatever my colleague will have left. I hope there will be none. But I want to make another very concrete example, because for me these are the things that really changed me. We went with Fundi, I think, and Mr. Schumann, if I'm wrong, it's a small mistake, that it's not material for the story I'm going to do. We went to one motor company, and we didn't set their site. And they told us that, you know, when we are going to have a new model, we train about 160% the number of people that we know will need for that model. In other words, to build it, assemble it, and stuff like that. And they were saying that their logic is that some people would drop out between the start of that training and the end of it. But it is also that in this modern day where you can keep cell phone records, email, Facebook accounts, if you are sophisticated more than me, you can keep contact with the people. They keep all of this information. Now, the rest of the car manufacturers in South Africa know this. They know that they always train more than the people they need, because there is no compulsion on them to keep the people necessary. General point, but it has a profound implications for how we think about the labor market. They say, once they have trained these people, in many instances, within a year or two, they are taken up by the motor companies. After they have finished, they have taken the ones that they choose to employ permanently. Right. So those people, by getting that chance, have that training, and this company is willing to put its money, by the way. That's interesting. That's why I'm mentioning its name, so that I don't market for it. But it's a good thing they do. They train, so those people end up having jobs as well. The company has incurred costs to train them, takes the trouble to keep their records, so that whoever wants technical experts in assembling cars and stuff like that, they just go to them and say, do you have names for me? Oh, yes. They take them, they phone maybe five of them, they probably would interview them and decide they take three. Now, if you had said to the company, once you have trained people, keep them, they wouldn't train them. How about making an argument that people were trained and then put the people in the seat? But they wouldn't train them. And therefore, they may not stand the opportunity to ever get into those jobs. It's a very practical thing. So we do an internship in the treasury, another valuable digression. We don't keep all of the people. We do the internship, we tell them. We don't have a job for you. But we might have it at the time when you have proved yourself. But be here, learn stuff. About 71% of them end up getting the job. Others, not because they are not good enough, they don't get jobs, but they go elsewhere. They do get jobs. And still others, they never make the grade. They end up having to leave. But still, they have something to put on their CV. I've been at the treasury. I can do a spreadsheet, and I know how to evaluate a budget of a municipality. This and that. It's a useful thing. Let me invite my colleagues to respond to the difficult question.
Just give the National Youth Accord.
Thank you, Honourable Members. So one of the concerns that we received when we were at NEDLAC was the fact that this incentive can't be the only thing that government does. It has to be complemented by other measures. So what was requested was that government presents its entire youth employment strategy so that NEDLAC could engage on the issue. In fact, when we looked at the COSATU document, which we had to access through their website,
and look at their proposal, which was a counter to the incentive. It's focused on the training element, that training should be the strongest part. So when the youth employment accord was put together, in it government spells out the six elements of the strategy as we see it. So the six elements are education and training that bridges first school leaving and then giving people exposure to their first job. It includes public sector employment, youth target sector sites in specific industries, promotion of youth employment, entrepreneurship, youth cooperatives, as well as private sector measures. So it's on page 13 of the accord. So the way that we see the contribution of this legislation would be to contribute to the private sector measures, which is a one leg. And this is what we feel the Treasury can contribute to, because we have a limited range of instruments in the Treasury. So the private sector measures can be any number of things. They can be tax and grant incentives. They can include things like challenge funds, like we've got for the job fund, and other cost-sharing measures between government and the private sector. So in essence, I think the view that, that we've taken, and that's certainly what we've communicated with other government departments as well, is that this incentive that we're proposing here is one element of the measures that are in the Youth Employment Accord. Other departments would then have responsibility and will come up with specific proposals, but we do not see the measures as being mutually exclusive. At all. I think that's my contribution around the Youth Employment Accord and why it ended up composed in the way that, that it was composed and ended.
A tail end to that, honourable members. When people have made a big thing, and I think too big than is warranted, the fact that in the Youth Accord there is a line that says there will be agreements on things. Again, I mean, we deal with this directly in the presentation. We would like there to be such agreement. It would have been nice. But absence of it can never amount to say, and therefore, you can't legislate. Because there's no agreement. I mean, it can't be that easy to take away the power of the executive and the power of parliament. It can never be that easy. That if people reach agreement with good intentions, that preferably we would want to have an understanding and have agreement on these things, and then all of a sudden it would mean that the executive does not have the power to do certain things that are given to it by law or the constitution. Similarly, parliament then loses its authority. It can never be. But under normal circumstances, if people are able to find one another, under the auspices, be it of the accord or any other, it could even be legislation, but the moment it begins to present itself in a way that it usurps the constitutional legislative authority of other institutions, then you have a problem. You can't almost have it as a barrier that prevents you from proceeding with things. Now, on the issue of, I mean, the Deputy Minister referring to the tax expenditure of 5 billion versus the other. Let me just simply say this, rather than responding directly to that. A lot of the time, tax expenditures get misunderstood. I mean, we interacted with the youth on this proposal at one stage. And they were saying to us, where is this 5 billion? Why can't you reallocate it to other things? They said, no, there is no 5 billion. There's no money in the bank on this. If you speak enough about it, you could see it pass. But in reality, all this is that instead of paying the pay-as-you-earn of X over to SARS, what the employer would end up doing is to pay X less whatever they qualify for by the determination here. So the flexibility, therefore, to move it to other things is quite limited. Because if you were to do it then, it's a complicated thing. But it did get misunderstood, and it's understandable because people see the number. I mean, only estimate, Honorable Harris, more will talk to it, but it's only an estimate, really. I mean, a lot of the time. For instance, what happens if, let's say by some miracle, the number of the people who are eligible, 4,000 employees, doubles relative to our estimate, then the tax expenditure simply doubles. You don't say, oh, now you have reached that tax expenditure, you no longer qualify, because Parliament will have passed a law that sets the standards which determine who qualifies and who doesn't qualify. Then we estimate in our head how many people will qualify relative to the design of the subsidy. What do we think would be the number? Simply because we know people would ask. Now, I never thought that people would then say, no, it's 2.3 billion plus 100 rand, and therefore it's bigger than the amount you had estimated. I mean, I'm trivializing it, but the truth of the matter is that that's an estimate. It's neither here nor there. We wouldn't want to kill each other as South Africans because the estimate is, different now from what it was.
And Chair, just to explain some of the factors that changed it was that the 5 billion was when we had the paper in 2011. Since then, we took into account suggestions, so reduced dead weight losses, the eligibility got tighter, so just fewer people will qualify. And remember that the figure we gave you last week was based on the remaining 2 years of this MTE. Yeah. Obviously, if we take it over 3 years, it would be bigger. So I don't think it's any big issue there. It's just our best estimate of the take-up given now the criteria, the way they've been refined. It's not reducing the number of people we want to apply to. I think, as we've said, we'd be very happy with this massive take-up. The other point to note is that we also projected higher growth. So if the economy doesn't grow, you're not going to get employment growing as far. So these were some of the factors which therefore, and I don't know if this is for something, but therefore where we revised our best estimate. And effectively now doing it for the remainder of the fiscal year, which is almost over. Do you want to say?
Chair, thank you. Just to say something very small on that. I mean, I don't think it's saying that if the cost is a lot lower, it's like a fifth as effective as it was previously. It links to your existing workers comment, and whether you think existing workers will actually be displaced or not. If we believe that the displacement penalties here and the displacement mechanisms we have are good enough, then by excluding the existing workers, you're just directly getting rid of that dead weight loss. So we're trying to make it as effective and using taxpayers' money as effectively by getting rid of those existing workers, which will decrease the cost a lot, but it shouldn't decrease the net amount of new job creation or decrease the effectiveness of the policy to such an extent.
So there was a question about what happens to youth that are currently employed, and the view that we've taken in that regard is if that is a displacement, the displacement provisions that we have included here would kick in, and then you also would have protection of those workers through the labour laws that we think should be sufficient if we can prove that they were simply displaced for no other reason and that there might have been some unfair dismissal. That would be covered in the labour law. But I think we might be open to suggestions about loopholes, but we see that as provisions that will cater for them.
Yeah. I'm going to be now very quick just with the remaining issues. I think the other issue that was raised was limited by the PAYE. I think, again, what we've said is we want this to develop and perhaps at some point go beyond the PAYE, but not for the first phase. If we want this implemented as soon as possible, then this is the way to do it. To the extent you're going to get out of the PAYE, have actual payments and so on, it becomes more complex. We're not close to those. We are looking at those options all the time. And that's why when we said sunset clause, what we meant, and we did have an error in the last presentation, we're saying, for the moment, this law is saying this is going to be there for 3 years. We said, after 2 years, we will in any case have a review, even have a small review as we're doing, but we'll have a significant review to see how is it working. And then, and that lays the basis for saying, what do we then do after 3 years? If it's a disaster, nothing happens, you stop it. And you haven't committed for beyond the 3 years. If, as we expect, there will be take-up, there will be issues that we may want to amend, you'll actually expand it, because we actually, the reason we're putting this forward is we are excited. We think, whilst it's not a panacea, it will certainly make some impact on youth employment. And therefore, I think arguments will be that we need more of it. And as I think the Catholic Church said, for us to be bolder than, and less timid with words that they use, okay? I think, too, so that's just the sunset clause. I think there's an issue on substitutes, but I think we've dealt with that. That's the displacement issue. With regard to refugees, frankly, the numbers are small, and I'm not sure. And I think we open ourselves up that, I mean, as you know, there are constitutional issues like on rights between citizens and non-citizens who are residents. We've taken that into account. Refugees also have rights, and I think that, frankly, it's not a very a big issue from a financial perspective. With regard to monitoring and enforcement, what we've said is we'll bring together the enforcement. Obviously, you're going to have the CCMA, for example, will receive complaints. You have other players. It's just putting that together to the Ministry of Finance so we can give a consolidated view on what's happening. I don't think there'll be any objection if other departments are able to help, that they will do so. So, Chair, I think we've dealt with all issues. Is there anything that I've left out?
It's just one small point on the PAYE issue, and it is a point that if you're above and you don't have a PAYE tax liability, you can't claim, so you're not an incentive. The way it has been written at the moment is there is a rollover. So even if you start and you become registered, it can roll over and you can accumulate amount. And then when this mechanism is switched on, when SARS has the ability to do that, they can then claim that entire amount of the rollover up to certain caps. So we are trying to include those firms that don't have the PAYE tax liability right from the start. We do have still have to discuss with SARS about registering firms without PAYE tax liability, but it is there in the bill.
Thanks, Momo, and your team in the DG in absentia. Any other follow-up question or comment?
Thanks for allowing me the chance. My specific question was on what the equivalent cost would be over 3 years, so that this committee can compare the cost of the consensus to the original proposal. And I mean, I've just done the maths myself to see if you think I'm right. If you take that the 1 billion to 2.3 billion of 2 years, if you simply multiply that out over 3 years, then the number becomes 1.3 billion to 3 billion. Would you say that that range is an accurate comparison to the original 5 billion rand tax loss estimate, given the changes that you made to the design?
I'm just a bit reluctant to get into numbers with MPBPS tomorrow, so we kind of almost want to say, can you ask that question tomorrow? because you start going beyond the MT. Yeah, but Cecil, you want to say something? I mean, I would, if you want to guess, I mean, I would say it will be well above 3 billion, but...
Yeah, I think as the DG has said, you know, these are best estimates that we do. In this year's budget, we've estimated a half a billion rand. Now, given the sort of delay in implementation, we're probably going to have a tax expenditure slightly than half a billion. So if you take that as a figure and you extrapolate that on a yearly basis, you're talking about an estimate of around about a billion rand a year. And again, that's an estimate. You can compare it with the 5 billion rand, which is also an estimate. And as you said, if the take-up is bigger, the amount is bigger. So if you want to take a figure work on roughly a billion rand a year.
Just two further questions. I didn't get an answer on whether there is any parallel process that this committee isn't aware of. There are people came to present and said they would make other interventions outside of this committee. Do we need to be aware of any interventions like that? And then lastly, Chair, just an indication from Treasury, what sort of sectors might the Minister designate? I'm obviously not going to hold you to this, but I'd just like to understand the thought process behind allowing that designation. Which sector, for example, could he designate?
Look, there's lots of other processes. We are mere officials. Obviously, some happen at the political level. We are not part of that, so we can't answer for that. But I would presume there would be lots of discussions at those sorts of levels. With regard to NEDLAC, for example, I mean, even now, we've been talking to the executive director there. Unions are approaching us, so we are always open to going to NEDLAC, making a presentation, explaining, etc., even though the bill is here. Not to seek approval, but certainly to explain and try and persuade. So there's nothing yet that I'm aware of, but we always, as a matter of course, when we have submissions, we meet with people who want to meet with us and either hear them or they have suggestions, we open to them. There's no explicit processes or parallel processes beyond that that we are involved in as officials. With regard to sectors, look, that again was put in because this started to be aimed at youth. For some demand on SEZs, can you expand on it? Once it was there, there were some suggestions. What about other sectors? There were no specific suggestions. The bill is just written in an enabling way that if somebody comes with suggestions and feels that in a particular sector you should go beyond the youth, that we wouldn't be close to that. But it's hard to say which industries we'd expect. I think the focus is on the youth here. And on the youth, it's applied to all sectors. The question is only, should it apply beyond youth to other low-income workers beyond the SEZs? But does anyone in the team have a thing which sectors could be designated on? Okay.
Nothing on which sectors should be designated. But I do want to indicate that other departments have started to work on the various elements of the Youth Employment Accord. And that those would obviously go to other committees or they would be announced through the cabinet process. So a lot of them are in early stages, so I can't give you details, but departments have started to look at other elements of the accord.
Madam, will that be the last?
Thank you, Chair. Can I address you? There are legislative changes that have been proposed by the department, by the National Treasury, like the definition of an employer and the age, which was pushed down to 18. Is it possible that we give them the go-ahead, or what are we saying at the committee on those, what they've just proposed in the chair?
I thought what is submitted today is going to be part of what is the violation to the committee later on. Unless National Treasury says it's important that they leave here with that understanding.
It helps to the extent that you've are happy with some of the proposed changes. I think Honourable Harris has made the point that the final ones will only be in the bill. Obviously, we nowadays are not just allowed to bring draft bills, they need to be certified. But, we're hoping that we can do this just immediately after this, that the state law advisors will make the necessary amendments, because if it's introduced on Thursday, time is short. But we don't, we've obviously spoken to the state law advisors on the specific bill.
Chair, even if it's not formal, has Treasury produced a new draft?
Yes, so you know, we can, I mean, I would have no problem in circulating it immediately after this meeting, but it won't be certified, so members can have a look, if that's what you want. But normally what we do with test legislation, as you know, is we say this is what we'll be accepting, and then you get the bill as introduced.
I thought the ghost wanted to be alive. I hear what you are saying. My tip would be the committee would be meeting on Friday, and by this time we should have this passed.
To be introduced by the minister on Thursday, as I'm saying.
Conducting my tables partly. Honorable members, I am not very, very certain that I can make a ruling on this one. But maybe we should allow you to proceed in terms of the proposed definitions, so that when we meet after the meeting of the prefect, the proposed bill to us, we'll go clause by clause and do all sorts of things. Yeah, okay?
Fine. This is the procedure, what's it, the money bills procedure, so all of that applies once you have the formal dating. That's why we try and sort these things out beforehand, because otherwise you have to follow those procedures.
Would we be able to accept the DDG's offer of distributing the informal amended version? I think it would be useful for us to see how they've codified their proposed changes, even just informally. But in the meantime, what do you say to the Treasury people? So I agree that we should distribute that.
Yeah.
We should allow them to go ahead and distribute.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, thanks. Okay? All right. Good. Honorable members, I think we do have another, in the next 20 or so minutes, we're going to have another meeting on a different subject. At this point in time, I think I must take this opportunity to thank National Treasury for reverting back to us with a comprehensive response on all the issues that have been raised. And I do take note of the fact that the issue around NetTech has been raised again, which was raised in transmission and raised today. But also your response, I think, is quite informative about the responsibility of a consultative forum, even if it is a statutory body, that it does not substitute other processes constitutionally. So I thought it was important that the committee will take that into consideration when we make our final deliberations of the bill. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I will be back here at 12. Is this so? Yeah. So we've got 30 minutes break. Now lunch is here. You drink. You know, we make sure that you don't overeat. You know, there's a struggle that Minister Mutsualo is constantly reminding us on. So Parliament is also aware of that. Thank you very much, Honourable Members.
I'm reading your response, your MTPB.
Oh, yes. Really? You agree to
it? I downloaded it.
Oh, great. I can send you a copy of MTPB.
Yeah. No, you should. Give it to me.
Yeah,
did
you
mention it? No, you did not. No, it's refreshing. Your twin gifts. But what is lacking in your analysis process? You're not factoring in global. You focus on domestic.
Our competitors, I think, they're on both in the same global.
Yeah, but you see, you know, I was an MEC for finance and economic development. At one point, Mpopo was growing at 6% above national average between 2001. No. Yeah, between 2001 and 2006. But the key question, or the most important fact, is that we're growing from a low base.
Sure.
You know. Now, when you locate South Africa, we've got 50,000 people within the continent, in the continent. Those that are growing at a higher rate, they are growing lower.
But that's not a comparison of more Chile,
yeah.
Thailand,
yeah.
Countries that are similar.
Yeah. Now, I agree that we need to have more competitive edge in South Africa. And the issue of lack of investment or attracting investment is going on. We normally focus, and I think we also focus on investment as a foreign direct investment. But we are not addressing the reasons and reasons of reserve that South African capital is putting on and not investing in the economy. And I think that's what we should
do. How do we get to it?
No, you need to tackle that. You and I must go and sit with banks and sit with the industry.
And find out what they need to invest.
Yeah.
You want to make that happen?
Now, I said, as you proceed, but also throw this one in, so that they also get the way.
I agree to do that.
Yeah.
And we are on
view
from now tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
I'll throw it in there. You'll see. I'll see that bright morning.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm impressed.
Yeah,
I will send you a copy in future.
Good.
So you don't have to download.
Yeah. Good. But also this other thing. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay,
you know, on this thing of youth and substitute, I know it's election time, we have to do that.
That's why you rush it.
You must also be sick of doing sour ideas and diluted and all that kind of thing. Okay, fine. Let it go there.
I'll accept it for you.
Sorry, Tim.
And I'm upset. I put my neck. Okay, because you always want to be honest.
Yeah, but I'm always speaking to the chain, speaking for everybody, no?
Maybe there's a minority view.
Thank you.
Thank you. easier just